Tonight, we're going to be studying the question, again, of to whom does Torah belong? But specifically, where does Torah belong? Along with the question of to whom. And we'll be doing that specifically through the lens of a series of stories about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Before we do that, what motivates people, what motivates us sometimes to want to limit access to Torah? By which I mean, we all know that there are institutions like this. We all know that there may be some people like this who feel that actually, in order to protect Torah, they have to limit access to it. What motivates those people? Why? What reasons might they have? Sarah Brooks says, control the message. I think that's really important. The content of the Torah that you teach is not necessarily the same as the content of Torah that people receive and will then pass on. In controlling the sort of people who have access to Torah, and I am not saying, God forbid, that I think this is a good thing. I am merely saying I think this is a thing that exists. You may think that that is the most effective way to control the message, control what people understand about Torah. Surei Rosenfeld says, fake information about the Torah. I'd love to hear more about that. Is that you're worried that the people who hear you will misunderstand and then go spread fake information about the Torah? Is it something else? Nancy Kaplan, concerned that some people might get the wrong idea. Great. Rena Fisher says, consolidates power. Great. Torah is very much, and I hope in the best ways most of the time, a form of power, but it can also be a form of power that can lead people to want to limit who has access to that power. It allows potentially people who are controlling access to Torah to consolidate power. Exactly right. Nina says, not wanting to dilute the authority of Torah by democratizing it. Great. One part might be trying to create a kind of class of people who have access to Torah. Art Vernon says, control who teaches Torah. Great. You teach someone Torah, they may then go and teach it. Are they the sort of person who you want teaching Torah or not? With that being said, a little bit more about what we're going to be doing tonight. First of all, I started by saying we are going to be looking at the question of to whom does Torah belong and where does Torah belong through a series of stories about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. It would be good to start with, who is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is, first of all, a Nasi, which means that in a post-Beit HaMikdash, post-Temple world, he is the political leader of the Jewish people. In addition to that, he is incredibly wealthy and a man of, I'll say, unparalleled scholarship. There are sayings in the Gemara that liken him again and again to Moshe, Moshe who actually received the Torah. That is said to be the extent of his accomplishments and the extent of his knowledge. Using all of those gifts, he does something that is undreamed of before him. By which I mean he compiles the Mishnah. What do I mean by compiles the Mishnah? If we're asking that question from an academic lens, we could be here for weeks, forget about 1 hour. All sorts of people have different sorts of answers to that question. The lens through which we'll be addressing that project tonight is one of the traditional understandings of what compiling the Mishnah meant in the case of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, which is he gathered together all sorts of collections of Tannaitic statements of rabbinic Torah and edited them into one definitive version that he meant to be the definitive version which would spread throughout the Jewish people. And indeed, spread throughout the Jewish people and became the Mishnah as we know it today. Now, why does that matter? Why does that project matter for the stories we're going to be looking at tonight? That project matters because it is in and of itself a decision about who is in and who is out. which statements make it into the Mishnah, which get left on the wayside, which are lost to history, or which make it into more minor works. Who has access to that teaching? By consolidating all of these statements into one definitive version, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is essentially saying that that teaching has to disseminate through him and his students. It's an act of consolidation, consolidation of Torah, consolidation of power. And I think when we read these stories tonight that are going to be about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi struggling with the question of where does Torah belong? To whom does Torah belong? Do I actually need to limit who has access to Torah or who has access to other resources in order to allow Torah to thrive? It's helpful to read them through that lens of that project, a project that on the one hand changed Torah forever, changed the Jewish people forever. Very likely, at least in the way that many of us understand history, allowed Torah to continue to thrive within the Jewish people. And also meant that so much and so many people fell by the wayside if they weren't included in that compilation. That's enough for me. Let's allow now the Torah itself to speak. Let's allow the Gemara to speak. We're going to be starting with a text that is a debate between Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and someone who I'll actually call his best friend, Rabbi Chiya, about where Torah belongs. Where is it appropriate to teach Torah? And we're going to use the content of that first story, that first discussion about where does Torah belong, as a sort of key to the rest of the stories we'll look at tonight. This is source number one, Moed Katan 16a. Once again, on another occasion, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi decreed that students not be taught in the marketplace, but only in a study hall. Talking about consolidating power, talking about consolidating Torah, this is literal consolidation. Torah belongs here, but not there. Or more specifically, the teaching of Torah belongs here, but not there. What are some reasons that someone would want to forbid the teaching of Torah in any place but the study hall? To begin with, it might be a question of dignity. You know what? I actually don't want people teaching Torah, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi might be saying here, while they're eating a hot dog and strolling along in Times Square. It's not appropriate for the dignity of Torah. It's not appropriate for the dignity of the people studying. Nina just said in the chat, focus, concentration. Great. Where do people learn best? That's a question that obviously many answers, as we understand that people learn differently, that people have different neurotypes. But one thing that's conducive to study for many people is an environment that is devoted only to study. Maybe it's actually about, I want students to be focused when they're studying Torah. I want them to be able to concentrate. When you teach it out in the marketplace, that is not going to happen. Betsy Forrester puts in the question of language. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is known to be a preserver of Hebrew at a time when it is falling out of popular use. Maybe he is devoted to that language and wants to make sure that Torah is taught in that environment, taught in that language, and has a sort of language immersion program in mind. When you say Torah can only be taught in a certain place, you exercise a certain degree of control over A, who can teach Torah. If that is your place, you may be able to control who is allowed to get up and teach. But B, also who is able to study Torah. Only the students who are allowed into the Beit Midrash will be able to learn. If you're teaching out in the marketplace, anyone who walks by can absorb the lesson if they're listening hard enough, if they're paying attention. And maybe part of what Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, in addition to all of the beautiful reasons that people proposed, dignity, the sort of environment conducive to learning, may also be saying, and it's important to limit who can come and learn Torah. Let's keep reading in the source. So he decreed that students not be taught in the marketplace, but only in the study hall. What verse did he expound to serve as a basis for this decree? The verse states, and this is a verse from Song of Songs that's praising a dancer. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of an artist. Just as the thigh is ordinarily hidden and kept covered with clothes, so too the words of Torah, which are the work of the hands of the artist, meaning God, must remain hidden in the study hall. Let's just all make sure we understand how he's using that verse. He's pointing to a verse in Song of Songs, which say, your thigh is like the work of an artist. He says, just as a thigh is usually kept hidden with clothes, although maybe apparently not in this particular dancer's case, so too must Torah, which is the work of an artist, the artist, namely God, must be kept hidden. Now, let's examine this analogy for a moment, this metaphor. There's something very charged here. It's a sort of feeling that Torah is beautiful, that Torah has exactly, as Sarah Brooks just said in the chat, erotic power, and that that power must be protected and must be confined. It has to be protected from public view, lest it be made profane. And in that, you also, in addition to where is it exposed or where is it not exposed? Obviously, along with that comes the question of to whom is it exposed and to whom is it not exposed? In choosing this metaphor, in choosing this verse, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is not simply making a claim about place, but a claim about people. Who should be allowed to engage with the beauty of Torah, and from whom does Torah's beauty actually have to be protected? Despite Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's decree, we're back in the source now, Rabbi Chiya went out and taught his two nephews, Rav and Rabbah Bar Bar Chana, in the marketplace. Rabbi Chiya is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's probably best friend in the entire world, so much as Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi has best friends or has friends at all. In that sort of position, real friendships are difficult. But Rabbi Chiya has a very different philosophy about Torah than Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi does. And in spite of the fact that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi has the authority to tell the other sages what they should and should not be doing, Rabbi Chiya says, actually, that is something that I cannot obey. That is an edict that I cannot obey. And he publicly flouts it by going out and teaching his two nephews in the marketplace. By the way, marketplace here is a stand-in for the most public place you can possibly imagine. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi heard what he had done and became angry with him. When Rabbi Chiya came at some late date to visit him, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi mockingly said to him, Iya, which seems to be a nickname for Chiya, who is calling you outside? Meaning, I hear someone calling you outside, you should probably go there and not be in here anymore. By asking this question, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was implying that Rabbi Chiya should leave his house. Rabbi Chiya understood that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi had taken the matter to heart and was insulted, and so he conducted himself as if he had been admonished as a self-imposed punishment for 30 days. Let's just make sure we followed what's happening here. Rabbi Chiya publicly defies Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, goes out and teaches Torah in the marketplace. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is furious, in a very subtle way, intimates to Rabbi Chiya that he is no longer welcome in his home. Rabbi Chiya understands that as a banishment, which is a very serious sort of discipline, from Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's home for 30 days. After 30 days, they have a reconciliation, which, by the way, we're not going to read this inside, but seems to be facilitated by Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet. And after that, they're able to have a conversation again. Concerning the issue with which the entire incident had begun, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi asked Rabbi Chiya, what is the reason that you, the master, acted as you did, ignoring my instructions not to teach Torah in the marketplace? Meaning, Rabbi Chiya, You deliberately disobeyed me. I hope you had a very good reason for it. What was that reason? Rabbi Chiya said to him, as it is written, wisdom cries aloud in the streets. Wisdom is meant to be proclaimed in public. Torah, which is wisdom, is meant to be shared. It is meant to be proclaimed in public. It shouldn't be something hidden away for the elite. It should be something shared with everyone. It should be something that is shouted in the streets. If you have a truth, and I personally live in New York City, so I have experienced many subway preachers who think that they have a truth that they need to declare in public, but I take this a lot more seriously. If you have a truth, you want to shout that in public. You want it to be heard by the masses. You want it to be disseminated because you believe that that truth can make the world a better place. Very different from Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's approach of Torah is something that needs to be protected. Torah is something that needs to be hidden away for the few. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi said to him, if you read this verse once, you certainly did not read it a second time in greater depth. And if you read it a second time, you certainly did not read it a third time. And if you read it a third time, then it was not adequately explained to you, as it is clear that you do not understand it properly. As in, that's not what wisdom cries aloud in the streets means. Let me explain to you what wisdom cries aloud in the streets means. The words wisdom cries aloud in the streets should be understood in accordance with the opinion of Rava. As Rava says, with regard to everyone who occupies himself with Torah study, inside the privacy of his home, his Torah knowledge will proclaim his greatness outside, as it will be revealed to the masses and they will see his greatness. Something really important just happened. What just happened? Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is pointing to that same verse, the verse that Rabbi Chiya said means, shout your truth in the streets, shout Torah in the streets, teach it to everyone who will possibly be willing to listen. And he's saying, that's not what it's about. You know what will shout aloud in the streets? Your reputation. Your reputation if you have appropriately studied Torah in private as it should be studied. Your reputation as a Talmid Chacham, as a sage, should be known in public. It is important for you to have that public reputation and for people to recognize it. But the Torah study itself should be in private. The Gemara asks, but isn't it written, from the beginning, I have not spoken in secret, implying that the Torah should be taught and proclaimed in public? Let's just note this verse is quoting God, God self. The Gemara is saying, God, God self says, I never spoke in secret. I, God, want my word to be known to everyone. The Gemara answers that verse is referring to the days of Kala. What is the Kala? Around 1 or 2 months a year, many of the farmers gather in to the yeshiva and study Torah with the sages. This is saying, you know when that's true? You know when Torah can be taught to the masses? At these certain times of year where we all know who is in the room and we're able to moderate what we teach appropriately. Not at all moments, not in the marketplace, not all the time, only under very specific conditions. And what did Rabbi Chiya do with the verse, your rounded thighs are like jewels? That first verse that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi pointed to say, Torah is beautiful, Torah is private, Torah has erotic power that needs to be protected from the masses. How did Rabbi Chiya, who thinks he should be shouting wisdom in the streets, understand that? The Gemara explains he interpreted it not as a reference to Torah, but as referring to acts of charity and loving kindness, which should certainly be performed in private. What does Rabbi Chiya think are the beautiful things that have to be hidden from public view? The good deeds that you do, the chesed that you do, the love and kindness that you do for other people, keep that private. But your Torah study, make it public. Let people hear, let the masses hear, shout the wisdom in the streets. Let's continue. We're going to see, I think, two different incidents which inform our understandings of both Rabbi Chiya and of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Chiya said to Rabbi Chanina, "I am working to ensure that the Torah will not be forgotten from the Jewish people." That same goal, by the way, that we pointed to in Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's editing of the Mishnah, compiling of the Mishnah, making sure that this definitive text has a version that everyone can study so that Torah is not forgotten from the Jewish people. Rabbi Chiya one day says to his friend, Rabbi Chanina, "That's also my goal. I am also working to make sure that Torah study is not forgotten from the Jewish people." But as we'll see, Rabbi Chiya goes about it in a very different way. How does Rabbi Chiya, who believes that Torah belongs to the masses, believes, as he said, that wisdom should be shouted in the streets, go about that project? He says, "I bring flax and I plant it, and I then weave nets from the flax fibers. I then go out and trap a deer, and I feed the meat to orphans, and I form scrolls from the skins of the deer. And I go into a town that has no teachers of children in it. And I write the five books of the Torah for five children. And I teach the six orders of the Mishnah to six children. To each and every one of these children, I say, teach your order to your friends. In that way, all of the children will learn the whole of the Torah and the Mishnah." Let's just make sure we understand what's going on here. First of all, Rabbi Chiya does not have the money that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi has. So when he's going out and starting a grassroots project, it has to quite literally be grassroots. He plants the flax that he's going to need in order to weave a net, in order to trap the deer, in order to write out a Sefer Torah, and also feed the meat to orphans. And he goes out, Rabbi Chiya, who is one of the greatest sages of his generation, and he doesn't go looking for hidden geniuses who might become Torah scholars who he can invite into the Beit Midrash. He doesn't go trying to create Batei Midrash throughout the land of Israel. Instead, what he does is he goes to backwaters that don't even have people who can teach basically elementary school children. And he writes out the books of the Torah, one on each deer skin. And he teaches each book of the Torah to one child. And then he says, "Okay, while I'm gone until I come back, you teach each other the book that you learned." And he does the same thing with the six orders of the Mishnah. Now, a few things I want us to notice here. First of all, this is Rabbi Chiya's philosophy about Torah in practice. Who does Torah belong to? It belongs to everyone, and you ensure that everyone has access to it by starting with children. You go out and you find any children who are not being taught, and you, even if you are one of the greatest sages alive in that generation, you take it upon yourself to teach Torah. And not only that, but you make those children into teachers of Torah. Meaning Rabbi Chiya could have said, "I'll take 2 weeks, maybe 2 months, who knows, in each of these little backwaters. I'll teach them everything they need to know. In that time, I'll teach them the five books of the Torah, Chamisha Chumshei Torah, and then I'll move on to the next one." Instead, he's taking these children and saying, "I want you to think of yourself not just as a learner of Torah, but of a teacher of Torah. You learned one book of the Torah, great. That's enough to be able to teach other people, even if those people are just your classmates. And that is actually your responsibility until I come back." It's very different from the Torah has some beauty about it that needs to be protected from others. This is Torah has a beauty about it that needs to be shared, and Torah has a beauty about it that allows even the youngest, even the least educated. And remember, in this time, knowing only one book of the Torah means that you're among the least educated, allows you to share that with others in turn. That's Rabbi Chiya. It is related that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi once opened his storehouses to distribute food during years of drought. Remember, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is fabulously wealthy. He has these storehouses of food that allow him to kind of act as a second Yosef, distributing food in years of drought and years of famine. He said, "Masters of Bible, masters of Mishnah, masters of Talmud, masters of Halakha, masters of Agadah may enter and receive food from me, but ignoramuses should not enter." Now we can read this in a few different ways. The word for ignoramuses here is amei haaretz, unlearned people. The less generous reading of this is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi has scorn for uneducated people. And he's saying, let someone else worry about them. That's not my job. That's what I'll call the less generous reading. The more generous reading is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi has limited resources. Even the most wealthy person at this time has only so much food to distribute. And he's thinking to himself and saying, what is my goal in life? My goal in life is to keep Torah study alive in Israel. And how am I going to do that in this moment? How do I facilitate that goal through the food that I have? I am going to share that food with anyone who studies and learns Torah, allowing them to continue studying and learning Torah, allowing them, to borrow Rabbi Chiya's words, to keep Torah from being forgotten in Israel. I'm going to leave it to you to decide which of those interpretations you feel is more true to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's character. Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram, who, by the way, is a Torah scholar, but who Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi doesn't know, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi has never met him, pushed his way in and entered and said to him, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, sustain me, meaning give me food. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi said to him, my son, have you read the Bible? Notice, by the way, that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, in this moment of confrontation, someone coming in and saying, please feed me, is dropping his standards by a lot. Before, he was talking about masters of the Bible, people who really, really know Torah, even if it's just Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the five books of the Torah. He says, those I'll feed. Here he's asking him just, have you ever read the Torah? Have you read the five books of the Torah? Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram said to him, out of modesty, no. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi continued, have you studied Mishnah? Once again, Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram said to him, no. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi then asked him, if so, by what merit should I sustain you? What merit do you have that I should give you food? And again, this might be, why do you deserve to eat in the less generous reading? And why should I give you this scholarship fund if you don't meet the criteria for the scholarship in the more generous reading? Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram said to him, sustain me like a dog and a raven who are giving food even though they have not learned anything. Meaning, God provides for animals. Animals haven't learned anything. Are you telling me that I deserve less to eat than an animal who hasn't learned anything? Give me food simply on that merit. I'm a human being standing in front of you asking for food. That's a good enough reason. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was moved by his words and fed him. After Rabbi Yonatan left, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi sat and was distressed and said, woe is to me that I have given my bread to an ignoramus. So this beautiful moment of growth that I think many of us read and said, aha, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi has learned something. He has learned that all human beings deserve to be sustained no matter what. Immediately, we see actually he's having deep regret after that. Woe is to me that I've sustained an ignoramus. His son, Rabbi Shimon bar Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, said to him, perhaps he was your disciple, Yonatan ben Amram, who never in his life wanted to materially benefit from the honor shown in the Torah, shown to Torah, meaning, let me tell you what actually just happened there. That was actually one of the sages. You don't know him. He wasn't willing to benefit through the fact that he's a sage. They investigated the matter and found that such was the case. Rabbi Huda Hanasi then said, "Let everyone enter." Why? Why should everyone enter? As there may be others who hide the fact that they are true Torah scholars. What just happened? Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram seems to be trying to teach Rabbi Huda Hanasi a lesson about everyone deserves to eat. You're doing something in this limiting of who has access to your food that is actually against this very basic human ethic. Rabbi Huda Hanasi goes through this, realizes that he almost withheld food from a sage. And rather than coming out at the end of it with, "And now I understand why it's so important to feed everyone," comes out with, "I'm not going to ask questions at the door because by doing that, I might accidentally deny food to a sage." And we again have this difference in philosophy. What does Rabbi Chiya do? He goes out and he slaughters the deer in order to feed the meat to orphans, and alongside that, make sure that everyone has access to Torah study, that all children have access to Torah study. Rabbi Huda Hanasi here, once again, faced with the question of who has access, this time to food, doubles down on there are only certain people who should have access. And indeed, maybe that is because my goal is to keep Torah study alive, and this is what I think is the best way to do that. And even after going through what seems to be a convoluted plan to get him to see otherwise, says, "I will increase access to food, but only so that I don't accidentally miss a sage." We're going to see two more stories tonight about Rabbi Huda Hanasi. And the question that I want us to have in mind as we read these stories is, does Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi ever change his mind? Does Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi ever come to believe that Torah study belongs to more than just the elite few? And if he doesn't, what do the texts themselves want us to think about who should have access to Torah study? The Gemara relates. When Rabbi Huda Hanasi would learn 13 aspects of a halakha on a certain issue, he taught Rabbi Chiya 7 of them. Here's where I think things start to get a little dicey. Not start, things already got dicey, but we encounter an additional layer here of what's going on for Rabbi Huda Hanasi. If we talked about who has access before and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi holding the key or guarding the door to who has access, we find in this text that he does that even with another sage, even with another sage who's one of the greatest minds of his generation, and even his best friend. When Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi learned 13 aspects of halakha, he taught Rabbi Chiya 7 of them. Let's just play with this for a moment. Why? What motivates someone to say, "I have these 13 amazing ideas, I will only teach 7 of them. I will only share, even with the best and the brightest minds, 7 of those ideas." Who is Rabbi Huda Hanasi to be the gatekeeper of knowledge? There's something very tempting for, I think, many of us about the gatekeeper role. I can decide what to give out and what to keep for myself. That is in and of itself a sort of power. And it's a sort of temptation for some people. Betsy Forrester says, doesn't want to be outsmarted. Yeah, what happens when you teach other people all of your best ideas? You're not unique anymore. Maybe they'll remember to say it in your name. Hopefully they'll remember, according to Jewish ethics, to say it in your name. But you no longer have the upper hand on everyone else. And Elizabeth Leggett says something similar with, because he wants to be special and that he knows something the other scholars don't know. And I want us to note this because this is the place where, despite whatever might be Rabbi Huda Hanasi's best intentions, Maybe he has the best of intentions in saying we're going to confine Torah to the Beit Midrash. Maybe he has the best of intentions in saying I'm creating in this time of famine a scholarship only for Torah scholars. Maybe it's still the best of intentions because he says my limited resources are devoted to keeping Torah alive. This is a place where maybe they start to slip over into just a basic human flaw, which is sometimes some of us, the most brilliant among us, just want to feel superior to others. And that's difficult, and that's a hard thing to overcome. Nancy Kaplan asked exactly the right question. If he wants to preserve Torah, doesn't it defeat his own goal to keep insights to himself since no one else will be able to carry them forward? Nancy Kaplan, you are not a plant, but you might as well have been a plant to get us to the next sentence. So whenever he learned 13 aspects of halakha on an issue, he would teach Rabbi Chiya 7 of them. Ultimately, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi fell ill and forgot all 13 aspects. Talk about forgetting Torah in Israel. There were 13 aspects. 7 of them have been shared with Rabbi Chiya, who can share them back with him. But 6 of them might now be lost forever. Rabbi Chiya restored those 7 aspects that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi taught him by reviewing them before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. However, 6 were gone and forgotten, as Rabbi Yehuda had not taught them to anyone. This is a very potent critique of what happens when you are too careful about who has access to Torah. And the answer is the ever-recurring fear of the Bavli, of the Gemara, which is maybe it will become lost. Maybe you have exercised too much control such that now no one will have access to it. However, we have a hero who's going to save the day. There was a certain launderer. Launderers are fascinating characters in stories in the Gemara. They recur again and again and again. Here we're going to see a launderer recurring at least twice in the stories of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. There was a certain launderer who would hear Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi when he was studying those halachot. Now, let's understand what's going on here. The story takes for granted that when someone studies halacha, they are speaking out loud. Even if they're only speaking to themselves, they're speaking out loud. That out loud repetition is how you study. And the Gemara is saying, there used to be, when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was in his own mind, entirely on his own, and studying those halachot that he would not even share with his best friends, with Rabbi Chiya, there was actually someone else in the room. There was the launderer, the guy who does the laundry and the tailoring and all of those things. And let's just make sure to notice, by the way, the launderer has access to the most intimate places in Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's life, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's own home. But because he is not a scholar, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi doesn't notice him, such that he's willing to keep these very closely guarded secrets and actually say them out loud in front of the launderer. Rabbi Chiya went and learned those halachot from the launderer, and he came and restored them by reviewing them before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. What should we notice, by the way, here? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, it never occurred to him to go and find the launderer. He may not even have noticed that the launderer was in the room. But Rabbi Chiya, who is of a different class and who runs around teaching Torah to children, thinks of the launderer and knows, oh yes, this is someone I know who not only was there, but who absorbs what he hears. Let me go out and ask the launderer to teach me those halachot that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi would have said in his presence. And Rabbi Chiya then goes and teaches, after learning them from the launderer, goes and teaches those halachot back to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. When Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi saw that launderer, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi said to him, you made me in Chiya, as we were able to learn these halachot that otherwise would have been forgotten. Some say that this is what he said to the launderer. You made Chiya, and Chiya made me. Let's just pause for a moment. I want us to notice this. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in this moment is seeing the price that Torah pays when we are too careful about who has access, too careful about with whom we share our ideas. And that is, we actually run the danger of not just harming other people who might be clamoring on the walls of the Beit Midrash saying, let me in, I want to learn, but harming Torah itself. Harming Torah itself by not sharing it with those who might actually become its preservers. Not sharing it with those who might actually, if given the opportunity, become our teachers themselves. I want to move on and see one final source. This actually is the story of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's death, and I'll just share a warning that it also involves a suicide. A rabbi's chat. One rabbi, meaning Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, was about to depart from this life. He said, I require the presence of my sons. When his sons entered into his presence, he instructed them, take care that you show respect to your mother, which I think is very sweet as Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's first instruction on his deathbed. The light shall continue to burn in its usual place. The table shall be laid in its usual place, and my bed shall be spread in the usual place. Those who attended on me in my lifetime shall attend on me when I am dead. He then calls in the sages of Israel and gives them instructions. And those instructions are, do not lament for me in the smaller towns and reassemble the college after 30 days. My son Shimon is wise, my son Gamliel Nasi, and Hanina Bar Chama shall preside at the college. Why did he say, don't lament for me in the smaller towns? He was understood to give instruction in order to cause less trouble for the people. As it was observed, however, when lamentations were held in the large towns, when everybody came, they arrived at the conclusion that his instruction was in order to enhance, this very generously says, the honor of the people, so that they may be honored in greater measure through him. But in the Hebrew itself, or the Aramaic itself, it actually says, because of the honor. And we're left to wonder whether that is the, the honor of the people, or whether that is the honor of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi himself. Meaning, don't have the people gather in those small backwaters, have everyone gather in the cities, because I deserve that sort of. We're left with that ambiguous, just as so many aspects of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's character are ambiguous. The Gemara relates that on the day of the funeral of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, a divine voice emerged and said, whoever was present at the funeral of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is destined for life in the world to come. First thing I want us to notice, whereas in life, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi believed very much in limits and possibly even in gatekeeping, literally in gatekeeping, in death, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi becomes an entry ticket into that most difficult of gateways. Anyone who showed up at Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's funeral, regardless of who they are, gains through that access to the world to come. We're not going to get into the theology right now of what does showing up at a funeral have to do with meriting the world to come. But I do want us to notice the symbolism of that. All these people who may never have learned so much of a word of Torah in their lives, but showed up because they have respect for Torah, because they have love of Torah, even if they are not someone who Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi himself ever would have shared Torah with, in this moment of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's death, all gates are opened before them, and God says they have access to the world to come. But there's a special certain person who we're going to finish with. There was a certain launderer who would come before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi every day. Maybe this is the same launderer, maybe this is a different launderer, we don't know. On that particular day, he did not come and was therefore not present at the funeral. When he heard this, that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi died, he was so full of grief that he ascended to the roof and fell to the ground and died. It's tragic. This is a motif that recurs again and again in the Gemara, the motif of someone so overcome with grief at someone's death that they actually die themselves. But what happens then? A divine voice emerged and said, that launderer too is destined for life in the world to come. What just happened? First of all, I want to honor the Gemara's telling of the story of the death of the launderer. This launderer, who maybe Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi noticed, maybe Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi didn't notice, loved Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and loved presumably what he represented and loved what he did for the Jewish people. And whether or not Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi would have looked at that person and said, you are worthy. You're allowed to learn Torah. You're someone I'm going to go out and teach. In his death, the launderer becomes symbolically the twin of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. At the end of the day, they die on the same day. And at the end of the day, the divine voice comes out and says, you too are entered into the world to come. Which may as well be God coming out and saying, in this moment to me, regardless of how you were seen on earth, regardless of whether the earthly powers that be may have thought you worthy, to me, you are entered into the world to come right alongside Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. I want to remind us of the questions that we began with, which are, where does Torah belong and to whom does Torah belong? I want to suggest that in its recurring stories of the launderer and in its stories of Rabbi Chiya's attempts to teach Torah alongside Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's prohibitions and limits, the Gemara is actually coming out strongly and saying, you know who Torah belongs to? Torah belongs to all those who are willing to learn. Torah belongs to the launderer who is standing in the corner who you never would have noticed and saves six aspects of halacha from being forgotten from the Jewish people. Torah belongs to the launderer who showed up at the funeral because of love of Torah and respect for what that stands for, even if he never learned a letter in his entire life. And Torah belongs to all of those students, all of those children who Rabbi Chiya went out and taught, and in doing that made them not only into students, but into teachers as well.